You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Kevin Alexander, an advanced heart failure trained cardiologist and assistant professor of cardiovascular medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for use healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Dr. Kevin Alexander. Welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on ATTR-CM. Today, we'll discuss the role of genetic testing in ATTR-CM with our guest and my colleague, Dr. Jovan Vaishnav. Dr. Vaishnav is an assistant professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and director of the Johns Hopkins Comprehensive Amyloidosis Center, where she specializes in advanced heart failure, transplant cardiology, and cardiac amyloidosis. Welcome to In Discussion and welcome, Dr. Vaishnav.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
So I wanted to have the audience get to know you a little bit. Could you tell us a little bit about how you got into caring for patients with ATTR amyloidosis and all the research that you've done in the field?
Yeah, absolutely. At the time that I was completing my heart failure training here at Hopkins, it was kind of a critical intersection in the field, I would say, when we were moving from a point of having no therapies to now multiple therapies. It was right when the ATTR-ACT trial was finishing, and I would say it was just a very exciting time and a ripe opportunity for me. Also, kind of at my center at Hopkins, there had not yet been kind of a multidisciplinary structure of care. And I felt that there was a great need for that. So kind of for a combination of reasons, was lucky to be able to step in the role and lead the multidisciplinary efforts here and lead patients down these important therapeutic decisions that now we're navigating.
Yeah, that's terrific. And, you know, being co-residents at Hopkins, I definitely appreciate the unmet need for ATTR amyloidosis, particularly in certain populations, which we'll get into. And so Hopkins is fortunate to have you and your leadership and all the research that you've done in recent years. So if you weren't a successful amyloid cardiologist, what would you do in life?
Great question. One that I don't think about too often. I would say I really enjoy writing. So if that could be a career, I enjoy kind of sitting and reflecting with my thoughts and being able to just kind of to write them. So perhaps something in that sphere, a writer of some sort.
Yeah, terrific. Well, maybe to kick off, to level set with the audience, could you tell us a little bit about the subtypes? I guess, what is ATTR amyloidosis and what are the subtypes? What is wild type ATTR and what is variant or hereditary ATTR?
Yeah, great way to start off. Broadly speaking, ATTR-CM or transthyretin cardiomyopathy is a specific cause of heart failure that relates to misfolding in the TTR protein, which ultimately leads to amyloid fibril formation and deposition. And when it manifests as heart failure, the fibrils are, of course, depositing in the myocardium. This process can happen related to, I think, two main domains. You mentioned wild-type TTR, which is, I would say, the most common form of amyloid we are diagnosing now, and that is non-hereditary. There's a lot we probably don't understand about wild type, but the main risk factor we know is age-related changes. Non-hereditary form of amyloid is wild type. And contrast that to our topic today, hereditary TTR, which is related to point mutations in the TTR gene. That process causes the misfolding and subsequent amyloid fibril formation. And it is important to distinguish these two subtypes. We'll get into this, but they are, I would say, two different diseases in a way, and very important to know whether one has wild type or hereditary TTR-CM.
On that note, let's say we have a patient who's diagnosed with ATTR-CM by biopsy or scintigraphy scan. Should everyone get genetic testing, or are there certain groups that in particular should get it? What's your approach to pursuing genetic testing in ATTR patients?
We've seen a shift or an evolution in diagnosis as we've been witness to, right? It used to be that all patients used to have to get some sort of tissue biopsy. Usually that was endomyocardial biopsy, from which we could do tissue typing and determine subtype. Now, the vast majority of patients are diagnosed non-invasively with scintigraphy. Scintigraphy is tissue specific for TTR. So with adequate light chain testing. You can confirm if someone has TTR or not based on scintigraphy, but you cannot determine subtype. You can't determine if someone's hereditary or wild type based on this non-invasive imaging. And so there is, I think, a huge role for genetic testing. You could argue even a larger role for genetic testing now, because on biopsy, you can actually sometimes get genetic information from mass spectrometry, but you don't get that with scintigraphy. So I 100% would emphasize that all patients diagnosed with ATTR-CM should in fact get genetic testing. It'll be helpful for us to talk about how we approach that at our respective centers, right? I think there are different flavors of that, but after confirmation of TTR, that's sort of my next step, is to proceed with genetic testing in everyone.
Yeah, I'm similar. I think that it makes sense to pursue genetic testing in pretty much everyone that has ATTR-CM. And like you highlighted, wild type and hereditary ATTR are separate diseases in some ways. I think that it's important to emphasize that the natural history of those two diseases can vary. Hereditary patients can have a predominant cardiomyopathy with heart failure and atrial arrhythmias and ventricular arrhythmias, or a more neuropathic manifestations with motor, sensor, autonomic neuropathy, or a combination of both. And to me, what's fascinating is how individual variants have different patterns of organ involvement, which I think is still not well understood and requires more research, you know, maybe from our groups and others. The other thing I would say is that the age of onset can also be highly variable and oftentimes lead to disease in earlier ages compared with wild type ATTR. So kind of knowing the TTR mutation can help counsel patients on what to expect and also what kind of screening and longitudinal surveillance. For the listeners, you know, let's say they've diagnosed someone with ATTR, want to do genetic testing. What, maybe just operationally, how do you go about doing genetic testing? What are some options? How do you approach it?
Every center may have a bit of a different approach. I think if adequately resourced, and what we do at our center is I refer to our genetic counselor, who I'm fortunate has a lot of expertise in TTR specifically, in addition to just getting pretest genetic counseling, which I think is important for any genetic spectrum of disease before you get the test. Patients can get helpful information on the disease itself. And so through seeing our genetic counselor and with appropriate pretest counseling, then the test happens the same day. Logistically speaking, the genetic test is either a saliva swab, that's what we do in our clinic, or a blood draw, after which the test is sent off and you get results. I think one of the, I'd say, positive aspects of doing genetic testing in this context compared to, for example, non-amyloid heart failure is it's targeted more often than not, right? Assuming you've confirmed a diagnosis of TTR. So you're less likely, I think, to get probably less than, 1% of the time, likely to get a result of uncertain significance. I think the vast majority of the time you're getting either a positive or a negative result. And I think that reduces the uncertainty and maybe some of the anxiety surrounding the test that can come with variants of uncertain significance. So I think once the test results, and if it's positive, then we also do post-test genetic counseling in that setting. And so that's the approach we take. Other flavors of this, I think, could include provider sending the test and then doing post-test genetic counseling if positive. Again, it kind of depends on what each center's resources are. Naturally, there are questions that come up with genetic testing, logistical questions from patients and their family members. And so I think it's been really helpful to have just a FAQ sheet or something really palatable for patients to review as part of that process to make sure they kind of understand what comes with it. And, these are really practical things that come up. Insurance coverage, what are the implications of a positive test result on such things as employment and, life insurance, et cetera. So I think having kind of digestible answers to those questions has helped us increase our genetic testing yield.
Yeah. So I think you made some really important points. And, some of the takeaways I heard from all this is, one, compared with genetic testing that we may do for other cardiomyopathies, the results are very actionable, somewhat in some ways binary. So either there's a pathogenic variant or not. There's not a lot of ambiguity of variants of unknown significance. And a positive result has direct clinical implications that patients can be counseled on. And then I think the other theme that was really important is the amount of counseling and information to give patients before and after the testing, or one or the other. I mean, I think, like you said, it depends on the clinical workflow. But unlike other tests that we may do where it's a positive or negative result, here's the diagnosis, I think issues around genetic testing, when something can be a heritable condition, we want to make sure that patients understand what the implications are. And also, too, patients will, you know, probably immediately start to think about what those implications might be for family members. So that as much as you can prepare them and help them to understand what the possible outcomes are, I think is extremely important and probably helps to reduce some stress and anxiety for patients. So I think Absolutely. Those are really important points. Yeah.
So maybe on that note, maybe could you talk about what are some of the more common TTR variants?
I think this is a fascinating topic and ties into what you alluded to before, which I'll reemphasize. We know that genotype certainly does predict and dictate phenotype in this disease, from heavily neuropathic to mixed to heavily cardiomyopathic phenotypes, as you mentioned. That certainly is a reason to do the testing and to inform patients. We also know that variants have geographic localization, and certain variants are going to be more common in specific regions. And so in the U.S., and I think, Kevin, you've done a lot of work in this subpopulation, the most common variant we see is V122I, or also known as pathogenic V142I, depending on the nomenclature. And this is the most common variant I see, too, at my center. I think it's a really important variant to be aware of. It predominantly affects individuals of African descent or Hispanic Caribbean descent, and it's been identified in up to 4% of African Americans living in the U.S. And we know from our work and from others' work that patients with V122I do have a worse prognosis compared to other variants and compared to wild type. It presents with more severe disease characteristics and progresses more rapidly, I would say. So I think really important to detect this variant in our African-American community. It has major prognostic implications, major implications for family members, which we'll get into, and is in fact the most common variant in the U.S. Contrast that, I would say, to worldwide. We do see some of these variants in the U.S. as well. I think V30M or pathogenic V50M is probably the most common variant globally, does have geographic localization, I think, to individuals of Portuguese, Spanish, French, Japanese descent, and can present, I think, early on with neuropathic disease or later on with cardiomyopathic disease, and certainly has very high penetrance. We haven't gotten into the topic of penetrance, but the V30M, I would say, tends to have very high penetrance, so also important for patients and their family members to get tested. And the last variant I'll mention, which I think we see a good bit of in the U.S., but in the U.K. and in individuals of Irish descent, is T60A, which can present with mixed phenotype and also has high penetrance. So I think that it's really interesting, and there's some unknown, but different variants, right, present with different phenotypes, and also different regions present with different phenotypes. So a V30M patient from Portugal may present differently from a V30M patient from Sweden. So knowing an individual's heritage and whatnot does allow you to know what their disease course may be.
Terrific. Yeah. So yeah, that's a great overview of the three most common variants seen in the U.S. And I completely agree that the V122I variant is the most prevalent in the U.S. And to highlight your work and others, I mean, really, you've describe the burden that V122I confers among the Black population, whether it's worse outcomes, increased risk of hospitalizations. There's been community level studies that have shown that the risk adverse cardiovascular outcomes for V122I increases after the age of 50. And so when you think about that number, that's tens of thousands, if not more, patients that are at risk for these outcomes. And so that's definitely led to some questions about what's the optimal way to identify these patients at risk and how to follow them. I think that that's something that will be important to delineate in the coming years, given the scope of patients that are potentially affected. I wanted to pivot a little bit. Now that you've diagnosed a patient with hereditary ATTR, because it's a hereditary condition, it means that there is a risk for family members to have this condition or to have the condition in the future. Maybe just give us a genetics primer of who's at risk among those family members. And then what's your approach for trying to identify whether or not they have the variant.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, these variants are inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. You just need one copy of the gene to be at risk and ultimately get the disease. Certainly if someone's homozygous, that would predict a more severe phenotype. I would say all first degree family members are at risk and should in fact get cascade screening. The age, right? What is the appropriate age of testing often comes up from my patients. And I think probably the most high yield age that I think of, each variant, as we mentioned, has a sort of a different predicted age of disease onset. And so certainly the variant identified can dictate some of this counseling. But within families, I think trying to go by the youngest age, the youngest family member diagnosed, or the time of symptom onset and the youngest family member, subtract about 10 years. And I think all of those family members of that age and higher would be in the period of risk. I do have family members who would like to get tested younger. And I think we do offer testing at a younger age with, again, with that appropriate counseling going into it, but trying to hone in on family members who are within that 10-year period of risk. The patient will get a very informed letter identifying the variant and identifying a mechanism to be tested at our center. And I think as we're kind of navigating this sphere, I would say, and as we're diagnosing more amyloid and as we're now having multiple available treatment options, and now we actually have a trial looking at prevention of amyloid in genotype positive patients who don't yet have the phenotype, probably now more questions about efficacy and yield of cascade testing has come up that are going to be really important to investigate. But I think that's kind of the general workflow in terms of counseling patients and their family members.
Our approach is similar. We try to target patients who are within that range of that predicted age of disease onset because they're the highest risk for having cardiomyopathy and or neuropathy at the time of cascade testing if they have a positive result. And you know, agree that counseling is extremely important for those patients, but also in particular if they're younger, what the implications of genetic testing are. And I think a lot of times, at least in my experience, when you do identify individuals through cascade testing to have a pathogenic variant, many of them, when you do the initial cardiac and neuropathy testing, are asymptomatic. And so the question always comes up of how you follow those patients longitudinally. And that's something that we're all starting to develop protocols for. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the frequency of testing for me would be based on how close they are to that predicted age of disease onset. And so as they get closer to that age where they may be at risk of developing amyloid, doing more screening more frequently. And as you mentioned, the prevention trial act early, I think will also help us to understand what the optimal frequency of cardiomyopathy and neuropathy testing are. And also, is there a role for doing preventative treatment? So, you know, treating with a stabilizer like acoramidis, does that prevent the onset of developing subsequent amyloid or delay it? I think those are important things. And down the road, as we think about cascade testing, that those type of data will help to strengthen the argument of doing cascade testing in first-degree relatives. In my experience, you know, I struggle sometimes with getting family members at risk to do cascade genetic testing and can be highly variable. Some families, everyone does genetic testing very quickly. Others, you know, even if those family members have symptoms concerning for cardiomyopathy or neuropathy, won't get cascade testing. Is that something that you've seen? And if so, are there things that you've done that can help improve the uptake of cascade testing?
Yeah, absolutely. This has been very much on my mind and as well as my genetic counselor's mind. You know, you're tapping into a lot of dynamics when you're talking about cascade testing. You're tapping into what is your patient's personal understanding of their disease and perception of genetic risk. You're sort of then relying on that patient to communicate more or less with a letter or some educational content that risk to family members. And so you're tapping then into a family member's perception of it. And then family dynamics, add in geography, right? Not everyone's local. When you zoom out, a multitude of barriers or ways that this may not unfold perfectly. I have definitely identified that in my patients. And I can't say I have one process or one intervention that's worked. I think this is something that we all ought to look into. I will say it probably starts with appropriately educating the patient themselves so that they have a good understanding of how genetics have impacted their own health so that they can then properly educate their family. I think it's always helpful when family members are physically at the appointments with the patient so they can hear firsthand what the disease is, what the implications are of an early versus late diagnosis, and what the benefit then may be of getting genetic testing and then being diagnosed much earlier, right? I think we can argue if someone's genotype positive and phenotype negative and then converts to phenotype positive, those patients are inevitably going to be diagnosed at an earlier stage compared to someone who never had genetic testing and kind of comes in with symptomatic heart failure. And so empowering or encouraging family members to be present at the visit, I think, has been really helpful. And then I think I've tried this and I would say I haven't been fully successful, but offering tele-based conferences with family members to at least give them the education and the instructions on how to proceed with genetic testing could be another mechanism. But I would argue there's a lot of work to be done to improve this process.
Yeah, totally agree. And, you know, I think those are points well taken. Cascade testing remains a challenge and we need to develop interventions to improve the uptake of that and to probably study it prospectively. I think we've covered a lot in, you know, the short time. Some of the takeaways that I'd have from this discussion about with Dr. Vaishnav about the role of genetic testing ATTR-CM are, number one, hereditary ATTR is an important thing to diagnose. So once you've diagnosed a patient with ATTR-CM, doing the genetic testing confirm whether or not they have a variant. It's extremely important for understanding the outcomes and natural history for that individual patient. It's important for consideration of cascade testing among first degree relatives. And the consequences of genetic testing for both patients and first degree relatives, it's important to make sure we deliver this information at a patient level and have the appropriate counseling in place. And oftentimes a genetic counselor can give us that support to discuss this with patients before and after doing the genetic testing. And, you know, hopefully Dr. Vaishnav and others will continue to lead the way in helping us to understand how to implement genetic testing among patients with this disease and continue to improve outcomes. Thank you very much for joining us today. And this is Kevin Alexander for In Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Transthyretin Amyloid Cardiomyopathy podcast series with our host, Dr. Kevin Alexander. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy.